Antonio. And you're agreeing to do this for the archives at the University of Texas at Arlington, voluntarily?
Yes, I am.
Thank you. We're going to cover four areas in this interview, and we can do it as fast as you can or as slow as you'd like. I would prefer you take your time or divide it in two parts, because this is an important interview as far as I'm concerned, and there's four areas we're going to cover. Who is Rosa Rosales? Childhood, parents, grandparents, where'd they come from, when did you go to school, when did you get notions of the public, the world, how it works, when you started getting social and political. Then we're going to talk about your political activity, and then we're going to talk specifically about some of the things you're doing now, and then at the end, a couple of issues and things about organizations and leadership.
Okay.
So, who is Rosa Rosales, some biography, on both sides of parents, and then your own personal family since you married and had children?
Well, Rosa Rosales was born here, born and raised in San Antonio, the daughter of Ramona Garza Mora and then Herminio Sanchez Salazar. And I was born in April 7, 1944, so my age is 53 years old right now. I was born in the south side barrios, not the west side of San Antonio, but that's one of the poorest también barrios of San Antonio. I never knew I was a child coming from a poor family. My father did a great job, my father and my mother. Éramos seis mujeres, no men, just my father. And I was born and raised until I was 18 years old in Acai Ripport, 1015 Ripport. And Ripport, uh-huh. It's right as the... Yeah, no, this one, R-I-P-F-O-R-D, Ripport. Yes, in the Talakai Ripport, Bigfoot, Green, McClary, Chico Eli. Esos guys estaban bien pobres. As a matter of fact, my house that we were born is what you call one of those shotgun houses. Yes, you've got a living room, you've got a bedroom, and you've got a kitchen. And we never had hot water. So I calentamos el agua en una cubeta and then te bañabas. But anyway.
Now what kind of house is this?
This is what you call a shotgun house.
Shotgun.
Because the story is that if you tiras un tiro, se va
all
the way through.
All right.
A shotgun or caboose house, I've heard different names for it. But even then, I didn't consider myself pobre porque mi papá era un luchador, you know. Vendíamos melones y sandías en el porche ahí. And there used to be other neighbors que yo, I consider más pobrecitos, les decía yo, peanut butter sandwiches, les damos slices de sandía. It was not until I was 18 years old that I realized, and we moved at 18, porque la casa esa era de la mi abuelo. Y cuando se murió,
what was his name?
León, Papá León le decíamos.
León.
Papá León le decíamos, él no le gustaba que le decían abuelo. Of course, mi papá viene de Monterrey. Y su familia es de
Monterrey. And this is your father's father or your mother's father?
My father's father.
Right.
My father's father no quería que le decían abuelo, so le decíamos Papá León. Y la familia de mi papá venía de Monterrey, México.
And how about grandma?
La grandma. La grandma también viene de, no es de Monterrey, es una parte en México. And the stories, porque yo no la conocía, mi abuela de parte de mi papá murió cuando yo nací, en 44. Pero decían que venía, era some kind de gente indígena, india.
Mm-hmm.
Venían Sánchez. Yo no me acuerdo su nombre.
Entonces, su abuelita.
La abuelita, yo sé que era Sánchez.
But you never met her because she died the year you were born.
No, she died the year I was born. No, I remember the same exact day.
Do you know when they came over, those grandparents?
Ellos se vinieron during one of the revolutions, sí, porque mi papá estaba chico. Mi papá tenía, no sé, there's different ages, pero mi papá dice, no sabemos his real age. Ahorita creemos que tiene 100 años, pero dice que tiene 87, pero every year dura mucho tiempo en una vez. But anyway, hablando con unas hermanas no hace mucho, que le pregunté, pues, ¿qué es la edad de mi papá? Entonces, abuela me dijo, tu papá tiene 98 o 100 años. So, yo sé que mi papá está, pero él vino de niño, con toda su familia, se vinieron, as a matter of fact, los dos últimos creo nacieron aquí, pero todos son de, los otros son de Monterrey. Mi mamá viene de Laredo, mi mamá viene de Laredo, Texas. Mi abuela sí era de Guerrero.
Rosa, I want you to be as comfortable as you want to be, but The more English you speak, the easier it is to transcribe.
Okay.
Otherwise, we have to do two transcriptions. One in English, one in Spanish. But if you want to say something in Spanish, say it in Spanish.
No, that's fine. I'm comfortable with English, except that I do tend to go back and forth. So I come from a world, you know, actually from a childhood that everything that was spoken was Spanish.
Well, let's finish mom.
Okay, mom.
Mom's from Laredo. How about the
her mother is from the old Guerrero, Mexico. And then my grandfather on the side of my mother was from Laredo, Texas.
Names?
Etema Guadalupe Mora.
And her grandma?
Bersabe Garza.
Bersabe.
Bersabe Garza Mora. Y ella sí venía, ella tenía como, yo creo que dos eran cinco hermanas y un hermano.
Wow, so there's a lot of women in these families, very few men, just women, children.
Yeah.
So they were both from on the Texas side. They were not from Mexico? Grandma. Grandma was from Guerrero.
My mother's mother was from what you call Old Guerrero, mm-hmm. Mexico. My grandfather from my mother's side was from Laredo, Texas. Mm-hmm. And my mother was born in Laredo, Texas.
Okay.
So right. My father's side, they were mostly all from Monterrey. Even my father was born in Monterrey, Mexico, and then the... As a child, they moved the whole family over to. Actually, they were in Fredericksburg, some little town outside the outskirts of Fredericksburg.
What were they doing there?
Apparently, my father's father already had a brother here who was working in the ranch, and so what they did, they came in and stayed with him until they finally moved into San Antonio. Mm-hmm. So they lived numerous years over there.
How did your father and mother meet? You know.
My father used to live on Novalito Street here in San Antonio, and they used to have a little grocery store. And my mother happened to be much younger than my father, as a matter of fact, 20-some years, I think, younger. And apparently their little house that they lived here in San Antonio was in back of this little store, Novalitos. It was, I think, on La Calle McLaren. And so my mother claims that one day, she had a little cat, a little kitty, and the kitty got stuck in a can, and this man, who happened to be my father, helped her with the kitty, and that's how they met. She says, my father says, would you like to go to a dance? And of course, my mother was 16 at that time, and from very strict parents, and naturally she wanted to go out and to a dance, and finally, they married. She was 16, and I believe he was about 33. And so they were married actually about 50 years before my mother passed away. My mother passed away about 8 years ago.
And you say you had a lot of sisters. Who are they, and where
my
are they now?
My sisters are, yes, we were six girls. I have since lost the oldest one. I lost about 2 or 3 years ago. The other ones are here. We've left and come back. I have, the youngest is Margarita Solis, she's born and raised here, and she's the baby. And then I have the Alicia Gutierrez, she's also next to the youngest. And then I have Yolanda Cuellar, and then I follow Yolanda Cuellar. And then I have another one that's older than me, we're only a year and a half apart, and her name is Herminia, named after my father, Herminio. Herminia is the, Elizondo. And then that's it. I'm very fortunate that I have my father. My father's still with us.
The oldest that passed away, what was her name?
Her name was Marianne Aguilar.
So she left the family?
Well, she died 2 years ago of cancer, but she was living here.
Mm-hmm.
It was a world full of women, but see, I come from a generation of I believe since my father was much older than my mother, that my father catered to my mother. I mean, I used to, with the type that, you know, in other words, he was the one to get up in the morning to make the coffee. And of course, because of the expense of, you know, the heaters or something, the heaters were turned off at 10 o'clock at night. Everybody went to bed at 10 o'clock at night here in San Antonio. Of course, we don't have harsh winters, but still we do have some kind of winters. And now I remember, I said, why do you have so many colchas, you know, so many quilts, you know? But that was it, because you see, at 10 o'clock at night, the lights went off and heater went off till in the morning. So he would get up real early in the morning, put the heater on, and make the coffee for my mother. And I remember all those things. My father always, but I think it was because she was much younger. And That's why he took care of her. He took very good care of her.
Okay. Well, you have married and you have children. Why don't we get that part now so we get
yes, the biography. I married in 1966. As a matter of fact, I've been married this year 31 years. I have three young men. I used to call them my boys and they get upset. One is 29, one is 27, and one is 25.
Yeah. What are their names?
The oldest is a junior, Rodolfo Rosales Jr. The middle son is Miguel Angel. He's 27, Miguel Angel Rosales. By the way, I've got to say this, Jose, not because you're here. Right around when he was going to be born, yeah, you were very much in the movimiento. And I was really very, very proud of everything you were doing, that I wanted to name Miguel Angel Jose Angel.
Wow.
After you, what happened there was that it came out that Rudy had an uncle named like that, and then we decided to put in Miguel Angel instead of instead of Jose Angel. So I just thought I'd let you know that.
How about that?
Yeah. So anyway.
The
middle son. The third child is Gabriel Yautequia Rosales.
Now there, Yautequia?
Yautequia.
You have to spell that.
It's Y-O-A-Q-U-E-T-I-A. Yeah,
is this a reflection of the nationalist spirit back in the
Yes, Orlando? It was. It means he who must fight enemies. That title was given by my husband. He was supposed to name all the boys. And I was supposed to name the girls, but I never had any girls.
Never got around the girls.
So that was it.
And your husband is from where?
My husband originally is from here, from San Antonio, born in the Alison Apache courts. And then I believe as a child at 4 years old, they moved to California. But then they do return back. Mm-hmm. And then they lived on the south side on Akaisuri.
All right. Well, then let's go back to your first school days. Any neighborhood school, any barrio school?
Yes. I went here in the south side in Nakaino Alito, in the street Navalito, there weren't any tracks. How you say you live on the wrong side of the tracks or whatever. We didn't have any tracks, but we had the street Navalitos. And Navalitos, if you cross Navalitos, if you know San Antonio, you cross Navalitos, on one side you have Rip Ford, Bigfoot, McClary, Chico Eli, or whatever you, and then and you cross the street, you have Thompson, all kinds of Anglo names. And those names, and those streets, it's just a matter of crossing the street. As a child, as I was growing up, to me, they were beautiful houses. I used to see them as mansions. Of course, you got to realize I was born in those three little room houses. And so sometimes I would walk across to go, because I went to College Garden School. From my first to my sixth grade. At that time, they didn't have first to sixth grade. And I went to College Garden School, which is on Harriman Avenue. And now, as I grow up and I see those neighborhoods, they're just ordinary houses. But at that time, I thought they were just beautiful. And basically, that was the Anglo side. The Anglos at that time, I used to live on that side, over here at Pura Mexicana. You know,
you speak English or Spanish at home?
It was in my childhood days, the only thing that we spoke was Spanish. As a matter of fact, there was only three questions that I could respond to you, because my mother had shown me that was, what is your name, where do you live, and how old are you? If you asked me those questions in English, I could respond. Anything else, I didn't know no English other than that. And she did a good job, because I remember that my first grade, I do have an experience that I'd like to say about, because I'll never forget that one. We went, my mother went, and there was this other, it was, like I said, it was an Anglo neighborhood. The whole first grade, because I didn't go to what you call kindergarten, I just started first grade, was all Anglo, except for two. There was myself, and the other one was Eloisa Gomez, I won't forget her name. And as we got into the room, I could see the teacher, which was Mrs. Smith, and you could tell she was upset. She kept saying, I kept hearing the word Mexican. And so you could tell by just this expression and the words Mexicans that she didn't want us there. So So sure enough, after a little commotion there, I think the principal and some other people came in there and they took us out of there. And they put me with Miss Evans, which by the way, was another Anglo teacher, but she was beautiful. Miss Evans, and but that was my first sign that I said, uh-oh, somebody here don't like Mexicans, and that was Mrs. Smith. Apparently that's what she was saying. She didn't want to teach us, and we were the only we're the only Mexicans, and we're the only ones removed out of the class, so that was my assumption with all the commotion. But then I had some good experience with
Congress. So can you elaborate on this? The Mexicans were in certain classrooms, not in Miss Smith's, but in Miss Evans.
In this,
or in other schools. I mean, how was the tracking done, or what was the segregation like?
As I recall, what happens at the very beginning, that school, Collins Garden, had a lot of Anglo students, a lot of Anglo children, very few Mexicanos, okay? In that particular class, there was only two Mexicanos, and that was myself and this other young lady named Eloisa Gomez, okay? Since the lady made a big fuss, all they did is, and they took us to another classroom, which by the way was mixed, and we stayed there, and that was it. That was my only, as far as my years here, from the first to the sixth, that I ever really encountered anything, other than, of course, the regular mean Anglo teachers that will put you in the closet. There was things like that, put you in the closet, hit you with a ruler, and all this stuff.
For what?
For running on the hallways. Everybody was afraid. I think her name was Mrs. Staken. Everybody was afraid to pass by the hall there because she tend to grab Mexicanito kids and put them in the closet. And in the dark, you know, people were scared. That was the talk of with the children there. But other than that, you know, I did pretty good. As a matter of fact, I remember in the sixth grade, I forget what it was. It was an essay or something. And the teacher, Mrs. Flute, calls my name, and I was the only one that made an A. So I had some good experiences. Other than the first day experience with it.
How about your barrio life? Did you play in the streets? Did you belong to the church?
My barrio life, you know, like I said, we were very poor, and the streets in La Calle Ripford, and even today probably they're still bad, there were some big old chuckles, and I used to love to run in the rain. I wish to beg my mother to let us play in the rain, and I'd like to sit in those chuckles, because it was like a swimming pool. Then we had Bigfoot, which was, two streets away. The next street was Green and then Bigfoot. And Bigfoot, it just overflowed at any time. And everybody saw it as a swimming pool. Of course, it was dangerous, but to us as kids, that was like, everybody liked to go, because it really, the drainage was so bad that it was really like a pool, a big old pool of water. So, we used to, like anything else, we used to play. My mother was very strict, didn't really allow us to go to other neighbors' houses, but they came to us, and we, the normal games of a childhood days, haciendo casitas, we do make little houses with the dirt, you know what I mean, the sides. I was a little bit of a tomboy, I guess you might say. I used to like to climb trees, I used to like to fix. My father bought me my first bicycle. My God, it was a huge old ugly bicycle, now that I think about it. It was those 26 inch, and he actually taught me how to drive it. Ride the bicycle, and I had many falls, but I used to like to change the tires. And I remember one incident that I messed around so much with the tires that I put too much air in one of them. When I was coming home, it just popped. Almost had a terrible accident. I remember one time falling from the top of a tree all the way down, and I was so afraid they'd get after me. I just went and laid down. I like to help my father also. My father was a handyman. He might have not known how to fix everything, but the man tried to fix everything. And so I was always following him around with a hammer and a saw. I remember making a bench, just watching him doing things like that.
So you're like your dad's favorite? Or?
I was a baby in the family for 5 years before my other sister was born. So there was a kind of a little jealousy, you might say, when Yolanda was born. I got over it, but I was 5 years old. I had, believe it or not, I used to sleep with my parents till I was 5 years old, and my other two sisters would get a little upset over that. But I was a little chiflada there, you might say. I loved to sleep with them, as a child. Of course, then when the baby came, I was thrown with my three sisters in the same bed. But anyway, and but I have beautiful memories of being a child. Like I said, I never realized I was poor because the old man did a beautiful job. He would bring the toys from his boss. He used to work at Champ Spring Company here in San Antonio. He used to fix the springs of the big cars. He was a laborer, really. And they would give him the used toys, and to us, they were beautiful toys. He'd come, and we really look forward to receiving those secondhand toys. But as far as this clothing, like we used to get three new dresses that bought them at Josky's Basement, and those big old Oxford shoes that I don't know how I wore them, but that was it, you know. That was for the school year. But food, everything else, that's why I never thought I was so poor until I was 18 years old. I happened to see a check stub on my father. And I realized, I said, can't believe this old man makes such little money. He's done a great job. So my childhood days were great. The only thing I remember was that, and maybe that's also where I get my activism, actually from both of them, but my father would tell me stories of how they would bring the Anglos in, and they would have the Anglos, them teach the Anglos how to do the job, and then they were playing the Anglos more. So they did report it. I don't know who did it. I don't know if it was my father, but they did voice concern. The Department of Labor came in. I believe he told me at least twice. And they got some money, back pay money. And I believe the last time, though, they did go on strike. The company just closed up and moved back to Kansas. So my father lost his job there. But you could see that he was an activist also at work. And then, of course, I have my father and my mother. I don't know if you know about those mutualistas, those organizations that started. Actually, they were survival organizations that had started. My father was part of being a founder of La Unión Fraternal Latinoamericana that started in La Calle McClary. And I started secretary and advanced himself all the way to president of that organization for 25 years. And then it's my mother, on the other hand, I used to remember because she used to go to these meetings. And the reason I remember, there were Monday meetings. Every Monday they would meet. And my father would bring us either pan de dulce or bananas. So we were waiting for him at 10 o'clock. I think that was the only time they made an exception because we had to wait for the pan de dulce and the bananas. And then after all, my mother then became, and my mother used to stay home. And then she became active with him and became the Presidente de Festejos for 21 years. And so they were partner each other. The Presidente de Festejos, of course, was a fundraiser. The ones that make the tacos and everything else to keep money coming in and make the dances. So my mother and my father were very together. And as a child, we used to go to the dances. I mean, even if the dance started at 8, we were there by 5. So, I mean, I really got to know this organization and my parents. As a matter of fact, the first time that I did go out with a daddy was someone that I had met in Tuluñón. But anyway, so we had a very active life in reference because of my parents.
How about church life?
Church life. My mother was religious, and I was very religious also. And in reference to, I remember when we were in Riffort, I used to ride my bike. Can you imagine? I don't know if you know the distance. Quite a distance, and you know there's an underpass. I don't think anybody would do that now. And real early in the morning, I get up and to go sing in the choir.
Every day for Mass?
Sundays? For Sundays. Uh-huh. And then, of course, we used to all go to catechism. So the my mother did raise. My father was not very religious. He was not much for going to church. My mother was. And
I assume we're talking Catholic church.
Yeah, Catholic church.
So which was the church?
It was St. Henry's. And then, of course, they did. I don't know what they did. They changed boundaries, and then we belonged to St. James.
And they were both called St. Henry's and St. James back then?
No. One is St. Henry's, it's over here on Flores, and the other one is on Theo.
But that's what their name?
That was the name. It still exists, and St. Henry's Church is still there, and St. James Church is also there, and on Theo. So we belong to Theo. I got married on Theo. I got confirmation on Theo. I think I made my first communion at St. Henry's.
Yeah, I must admit that I'm confused about Henry, because James is an apostle, and I can understand that, but I've never heard of a St. Henry.
There must be one, because that's
right.
The name, St. Henry.
Okay.
Did you ever run for queen, or did you ever participate in the CYO, or did you ever Hijas de Maria, or things like the choir that you talked about?
No, I just belonged to the choir as a child. I didn't belong to any organizations. There was one incident that happened, and perhaps that's what, and I should have realized, but it kind of, when I was in the seventh grade, I joined a choir. I've always said I've always liked to sing, I don't have a voice. And I remember the teacher was Miss Berry, and she was asking us to bring a white blouse and a black skirt to belong, you know, to the choir, because we were going to go do some singing in some different places as the choir, you know, as a group. And I remember asking my mother if, you know, I needed the white blouse and the black skirt, and she said, "There's no money, mija." So instead, that's when I learned very, very fast there that you should not lie, you know, because, you know, you should just say the truth. I'll be honest with you, I was ashamed to tell my teacher, the music teacher, that there's no money. So I lied about it. I went up there and I said, my father, because she had said we're going to go at night and all this. My father does not want me to be out at night, you know, and all this. And I felt real bad because if had I told her the truth, she probably would have helped me get the blouse and the skirt. But she kept saying, "Well, that's no problem. I will go talk to your parents and I will take you and bring you." And I felt so bad because I could not get out of it. So I had to stick to my word and said, "No, no, no." He said, "No, no, 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 no." And it kind of like, I don't think it really, you know, I cannot say it had long damaged my whatever, but it kind of dampened my spirit as far as joining other organizations, because everything costs. If you join the band, it costs. If you join anything else, it costs money. And I know my mother was going to say there's no money. So what I did, I kind of went into a shell for a while. And because I remember I was even in high school, I was asked to join the what you call the Honor Society, and I never went. I never went, and as a matter of fact, I never joined any other clubs or anything like that. I was very shy and timid, as a matter of fact, all through my elementary and through my high school. I kind of say students or persons that see me now, they were with me in high school, cannot believe this is the same Rosa. But anyway, I remember even when I graduated with a 93 average, which is an A-, all through my, from the 7th to the 12th.
Did you study at home, or this was just pretty natural?
I would say that I study. I cannot say I didn't study that much, but I did study. I did prepare. I gotta say that. I did prepare. Because I used to remember the kids would say, "Oh, I don't know, grades are coming out. I don't know what I'm gonna make. You know, am I gonna pass or fail?" And I used to say, "Well, if you have all your grades and you made okay, what's the worry?" You know what I'm saying? So I did study.
Where did you study? How could you with six girls and two parents in a three-room shotgun house?
You'd be surprised. They bought us, I remember buying us an Underwood old typewriter. God, la cosa estaba. It was antique at that time, but they would buy us the necessities, you know. And I remember, you know, that we did have, and I got to say that I had an older sister, Minnie, the one that followed, you know, she's only a year and a half. And she was very, very helpful with me. She was always there to give me support. And I remember one time I took biology and we had to stuff an animal or something. I just couldn't do it. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't do it. She did it. I took it in. We stuffed a rabbit or something. I couldn't do it, you know. And she was brave enough to do everything. And I took it as my project, but it was her. But it's the, I remember that time when my advisor, Miss Lubbock, I think it was her name, she comes in and says, "Rosa, you have a good point average. Do you want to go to college?" And just like that. And I said, "No." "Okay, thank you." And she left.
And did you know what she was asking?
No. She didn't explain anything. "You can get a scholarship. You can do this. I can help you, you know." Namasi. "You have a good point average. Do you want to go to college?" And when I said no, same way. So that was it. But other than that, you know, I had a pretty good.
And at home, was there any impulse about college, or did your dad want you to get married and get out of the house?
No, in the house, they were very traditional. In tradition, you get your high school and you go to work. As a matter of fact, I couldn't find. I wanted.
This is take two. We better start with a question again. What are your prospects for the winning the election?
I think my prospects are pretty good. I'd like to believe I have a lot of support in the state of Texas. I've got support from California, New Mexico, Arizona. Basically, I would say that I would play a much more active role than Lula Cass lately been playing. I've got to give credit to Glenn that she got us out of the debt. We had a lot of outstanding bills or whatever. But now it's a time to take a very active role, and I think I could be the person to do that. I've demonstrated that I can and will address the issues very aggressively. The issues of education, I think we're in a state of alarm, not only the state of Texas, but nationwide. I think that the dropout rate is so high in the Latino community that we must do something more than what we're doing. And I think we need to make President Clinton, or whoever's the president, to have a national Latino summit with the president to see what are we going to do with this, okay? I think also the immigration issue, I've always said, I've been told it cannot be done, but I sure would like to try it. I don't see no reason for it. You know, why are we having all these problems with Latinos being here in the U.S. for so many years, some 20 years, 25 years, and then they have to go through this INS process, I call it a police agency. Why do we have to do that? Why can't we have an executive order where everybody that's been here, say 20 years or 15 years or whatever, automatically becomes a citizen? What is wrong with that? As long as they've been law-abiding and everything else is clear, why not? What's wrong with that? You know, that's what I'm saying, that needs to be done. I'm also totally against the INS, and I don't think we're taking a strong stand. I think we should go with an advisory committee to dismantle the INS. I see this as a police agency that needs to be dismantled. It should be a service agency, and if indeed it hasn't done it for all these years, what do we need it for? Get rid of it. So there's many issues that I feel the projects, I think that LULAC can become much more involved in the housing issue. There's a lot of need for affordable housing, and I think that we used to be very active in it. We need to go back into those issues and get different projects in housing and helping our people get first-time buyers, helping them get into housing in developments or whatever. Economic development is another one that I think that LULAC, for whatever reasons right now, is not up to par. We need to look into it. I know we have all kinds of committees, but there's been no action. So I feel, and the issues of discrimination, of affirmative action, I think that LULAC can play a much more active role than what we've been playing. And not to take away from the lady, I think I can enhance the movement that she did in stabilizing the organization, that it did go through some turbulent years.
You're talking about Belen?
Belen
Robles.
Belen Robles, that now I think we have our house in order, that now is the time to increase membership and aggressively address the issues that I've spoken about.
What is the membership of National LULAC?
You know, I really don't know, but I know that it has not grown the way it should be growing.
What is it, more or less, is your question?
To be honest with you, I don't know, but I know that in the state of Texas, you're talking about maybe 5,000, and I'd like to see it much more than that.
Paid members.
Paid members.
The $35 fee for San Antonio, is that average for the state, if you belong to LULAC and other places?
That runs average. It runs from 25 to 35.
25 to 35. So do you think that LULAC can continue in this day and age to operate as a volunteer organization at the top level? Shouldn't there be paid staff?
We've also considered that since the National is getting down an executive director, and about there must be about four or five positions that they are going to have as paid staff. I think that the same should apply for state directors, where they could have a paid staff, which should be an executive director, a secretary, and probably. I've always said one of the things that LULAC needs, and I see it as an organizer that I am myself, you know, the need to organize is so important that you need a full-time paid staff. that cannot continue to be in a voluntary. And I think that one of the things that we can do, not just the organizing councils for the sake of organizing for growth, but to show those councils exactly how to run an organization as far as rubber rules of order. You can control a meeting and do so much things if you know your rubber rules of order, showing them how to address the, how to do manual, how to do address discrimination, police brutality. A lot of times when we go to little towns and we ask them, they say, I complain and I talk to the principal, I talk to the superintendent, and nothing was done. And I say, okay, show me what you have in writing. ¿Qué puso por escrito? Well, no, señora, they told me, they told me. No, that doesn't work. Another thing that our people don't know is, for example, you know, they're entitled to see all the records in the school district. They're entitled to file formal complaints. They're entitled. And so all of these things, if LULAC can become more actively involved in forming councils and educating our people who form these councils, how they themselves can address the issues, I think will become much more powerful.
What's the state budget look like? What's the amount?
State budget. I think the state budget when I was, and I think it's about the same, you're talking about 10,000, maybe 15,000 a year. 10,000 from membership and the conventions. And then we do have an account that's for scholarships, and that scholarship fund runs about 5,000. But that's strictly earmarked for scholarships. So you're talking about 15,000 to 20,000 a year.
And the national, we agreed that it was basically close to $1 million now?
I think so. I think that was.
Is Texas the largest of the council states?
Well, we're competing with Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico had more councils than Texas?
Puerto Rico and Texas are about like tied in.
Is the number indicative of the number of councils there are? Like you belong to council?
649.
That means that at that time there was 649 councils?
Yes. Yes, and I think right now the latest number is 4,544 something.
Did they ever go back and scratch off the ones that are defunct there, or just keep adding the numbers?
As a matter of fact, a lot of members that, or a lot of people that want to organize, maybe once belong to LULAC, they want their own number. So a lot of the defunct numbers do come back. I don't know if they scratched them off or not, though.
Because, you know, just doing rough math, 4,500 chapters, that's chapters.
Yeah.
At 50 bucks, 25 bucks a pop. That's well over $1 million just for the charter dues.
Well,
so there's a lot of money here if that's true.
That's what I've been told. I don't know the latest report that they said it was close to $1 million or $1 million. Okay.
All right.
That's one of the things that I've always said. That's another thing. When I get elected national president, I'd like to see a full-time organizer, and just organizing 500 new councils brings you $500,000.
All right, well, let's switch tracks here, unless you want to make some comment about LULAC or labor, because I'm going to switch over to a totally unrelated subject area now. Anything that I should have asked you that you didn't cover about labor or about LULAC, or your personal activism? I mean, why do you recommend this way of life?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. It has taken a lot of my time, but I've enjoyed it. I think when we win something, I remember we went to a little town, where Bernardo was born, at Welder, Texas, I think. And one of the things that they were doing is that they were changing the rules of being in honors, in voting honors. And that's important because you can become the how do you call it, the valedictorian, and then the other one that you get scholarships.
Salutatorian.
And then, and so this parents called us, were Mexicana, had been told that she didn't need to enroll in these honors classes, and then they made them a requirement at the midstream. And so, of course, we thought that was wrong. I mean, if you're going to change it the next year, you know? And, of course, doing that, it would drop her. She wasn't going to be the top one. And, of course, the one that was going to be the top one was going to be an Anglo lady, young lady. And for the first time, because we've been making friends, and sometimes we win, sometimes we don't. But this one, I didn't think we were going to win. I remember there was a black guy that was a board member, and he went with us, and we won. And I think it's victories like that where you say that you're just making a presentation, announcing you with LULAC. And of course, I remember I made a speech that said, if we sued the governor of Texas, remember Ann Richardson, the education First, Lulac versus Ann Richardson, the higher ed. I said, if we can sue the governor of Texas, we can sure come and sue this board for discrimination. And, you know, it was just a great feeling when the board came. They left it, and the young lady was able to continue her studies and become the number one. And, of course, the other young lady came out that she was Native American or something. But the idea is that we were able, through LULAC, using the organization. And I think it's victories like that keep you going. Because I said that we're not perfect by no means, and we cannot resolve all the problems, and we don't have lawyers, and we don't have the money. But we have helped a lot of people through the organization, and I think that's rewarding to me.
All right. Well, let me switch tracks here. Let's talk a little bit about leadership. What is that?
You know, I really don't have an answer for what is leadership. You know, I've never considered myself a leader either. I've considered myself that I've been put in a situation where things have to be done, and I make a decision and we do them. I must say that I've had tremendous support from the community, and I guess it's because through the organization and through the union that they've seen me addressing issues of discrimination, of unfairness, or whatever, that in essence has placed me, I guess, in a leadership position through LULAC, because I was a state director, because I was a district director, I was a council president. But I don't know how to say what is leadership in itself, other than if the problems are there and you feel you want to take a role on it, take it on. I've always said that if indeed you're able to do it, and I realize not a lot of people can do it because of their jobs. You know, if you go out and be outspoken, you're going to be fired, you know. I've been very fortunate to work for a union that, like I said, we enhance each other. Community involvement and unionism, to me, it goes hand in hand. And when you put that link together of community and union, because the union, what is it? It helps the worker. You know, it helps the worker better his working conditions, his wages, and all that. So, in the community, what are we trying to do? Better the community. You know, so that goes hand in hand. So, I think that that type of job that I have and my involvement in LULAC has, if you want to call it, has created the leadership that I would have.
What are some of the skills necessary to be a good leader?
Necessary, okay. I think you have to be a good listener. You got to, many times, and you also got to take criticism. You also have to, aside listening and criticize, you also have to, if you say you're going to do something, in other words. And you also have to level with people. If you cannot do something, it's important, just tell them. Don't provide false expectations, because then, you know, it's going to be bad for everybody, man.
It seems like you're describing qualities, so why don't I ask you about qualities? What are the qualities of a leader?
The qualities of a leader, okay.
It sounded like you were describing, I asked you about skills, you know, I mean, certain things that you really got to...
Well, skills, in reference to skills, you better be prepared and do your research. That's very hard sometimes for people to do, but... the only way that you can address an issue, and the skills would be your writing skills you have to have, speaking skills you have to have, but I think those all come natural. If you're committed and dedicated to doing something, you don't have to be well educated, you don't need a college degree, you don't even need a formal education, as long as your commitment and dedication are there. Okay. To me, it did help me that I did go on and got into higher ed. And broke out of my shell, but I see that the basic skills, reading, writing, research, commitment, dedication.
How do you stay informed?
How do I stay informed? People send me information. I read the paper and they send me information. The media calls me and tells me many times what's going on, and the facts is the biggest invention that I give credit to, that you can get informed right away.
Do you have email?
No, I don't have email.
Does Rudy?
I don't think so.
Okay. Who is the most effective leader in our community, Mexican Americans, of all time?
Here in San Antonio, Texas.
Let's take them all three, national, state, local.
I'd hate to mention one and hurt somebody else. I don't
mention two then. Say they're tired.
I think someone has been very instrumental, particularly right now with the affirmative action, is Senator Barrientos. I think that I would see him as a leader in forming the group that he did, and there was some legislation that is going to make a difference. But as he come back to the affirmative action effects that we're having, La Otra Señora Rangel is another one that I think is very, very good. Irma Rangel, I like her. As far as I don't know who else is there. I could really mention that I've.
How about locally?
Locally.
The most effective ever.
The most effective ever. I don't really know. We really have anyone that's been that effective here in San Antonio. We have so many problems.
Okay, nationally.
National. I think, let me see, Mexicano, Latino, whatever, let me see. As far as addressing the issues, or just as a leader?
Well, you can qualify it. I mean, just.
I don't know. I really don't know.
All right. Who do you look up to, or who do you look to for leadership for you?
Who do I look to? I look forward to the LULAC organization for direction, and the issues are being brought forth. I think that I'm very proud to be LULAC, and I think the LULAC organization, like I said, I abused it, but they've also been very much part of my growth of being a so-called leader. The organization has helped the membership.
I think I know what you're going to say here, but I still got to ask. Which has been the most effective organization for Mexican-Americans nationally?
Of course, I'm biased. I would say LULAC.
Who's number two?
Number two, I would say Council de la Raza.
The National Council of
Raza. National Council of Raza.
Why did you say earlier that MALDEV was a spinoff of LULAC?
Because it was.
Well, explain that.
Okay, if I'm not mistaken, it was Tejerina and Luna, Senator Luna, and another, oh yes, ¿cómo se llaman, señores? Mario is originally from here, is the past national president, I forget his last
name. Obledo.
Mario Obledo. Those are the ones that, or some of the group that started the legal arm of LULAC. It started as the legal arm of LULAC, and then it just went on its own. I would say the third organization would be MALDEV. MALDEV and then Southwest. Those organizations I have a lot of respect for, all of them. And then, like I said, I'm biased to put LULAC on top, but MALDEV, for whatever reasons, there's all kinds of rumors that it's lost or it's in debt or something because of the building that they bought, and has not, I think it's changed its direction into more immigration. That's what I've been told, I'm not sure. But it's also been a very instrumental in how the LULAC. I think we played together, and they would file the lawsuits, and we would put the plaintiffs.
You mentioned on the leadership questions two individuals, and both were elected officials. Do you think elected officials empower our community?
Oh, definitely. I think we need a hell of a lot more Latinos, Mexicanos into elected positions.
Go ahead.
No, it's okay.
About half of the members of the legislature that are Mexican American are now going to be women.
Oh, really?
Yes. The elections of Dora Olivo and the election of Norma Chavez in El Paso, I think women are just one shy of equaling the number of men in the Texas legislature. Do you think women do politics differently, and if so, how?
I think think, and I don't mean to be disrespectful to men, I think women look more into the details, and they're more community oriented for whatever reasons, because they've been, they've actually, women have held so many roles, like for example, their mothers, their wives, their cooks, their housekeepers, and their workers out in the community. I mean, so I feel because of the wide range of activism as the role of a woman and as the role as a person, that that they would have a little more in depth into things. Of course, I'm biased. I'm a woman, but that would be my answer to it. And I wouldn't want to be seen like, I've always said, I'm not a feminist. I am a humanist.
What's the difference here?
Well, feminists tend to, the way I see it, okay, feminists tend to be geared more into just women issues. As a humanist, I would not only women issues, which are very important to me, but also issues of community issues that involve men and women. And I say that would be different. You know, sometimes feminists get carried away with wanting to, and with all due respect, I mean, they have every right to wanting more women on boards, more women in commissions, in top level positions, but that's the same thing we would want of the men. You know, if they're also being discriminated, so I mean, of course, and I realize that there's been more discrimination on the Latina woman than in the male, but it's getting the masi, you know, rather underneath each other. So that was the reason I would say I'm a humanist and not a feminist.
What are your views on the relations with Mexico?
I think the relations with Mexico have to become much, much more closer. What affects, one of the reasons that if we do not deal with the problem that Mexico's having as far as the employment and wages and working conditions, all that, we will continue to have that. People want to, they're only human beings. You know, they want to come to a better life. Whether that quote-unquote is a better life here or not, you understand what I mean? But unless Mexico and the U.S. together, for example, the NAFTA is a failure, okay, as far as the working class people. The ones that you could say were good, the big corporate America who was already there already to begin with. All it did is it opens the gates wider, and they made more money. As far as the small businessmen, Mexicano, they've been erased. As far as helping the infrastructure and the environment situation, no se hizo nada. Those side agreements, no tuvieron no pull at all. So what's happening now, it would be for Mexico and the U.S. to address specifically those issues that involve the workers, that involve the environment, that involve the infrastructure. Yes, so that's important. Because unless Mexico, if Mexico does not up its wages and the working conditions at all, where are they going to go? ¿Se van a venir para acá? That's survival. It's not that they love the U.S. so much, it's survival. You know, everybody wants to survive to raise their family. And so, and as long as those issues are not being addressed, I don't think that we're going to get any different of what's happening right now.
In terms of us being Mexican-Americans, what should our relationships be with Mexico?
It should be a great relationship. I think it's almost igual. I'm a firm believer. I don't like the words mojados. I don't like the words, como le dicen, wet bags or whatever, you know, all kinds of names. And particularly, you know, that creates a division. Because I know in Mexico, que somos pochos, ¿no? And then over here, in other words, like they say, we're strangers in one's own land. But I think that there has to be if we could finally recognize que somos iguales, as human beings, as Latinos, as Mexicanos, that we have to work together. And I think that will go much further than creating, the establishment would like to see us that we're different. You know, that we're also in the Mexican also taking.
Well, let me ask you that tough question. During the early days of the Chicano movement, we saw this as our own nation, the Chicano nation, Aztlan. You seem to be saying that we're the same, so that we're an extension of Mexico. We should, you know, fight to put this all back together again as one large Mexico. Am I misquoting you, or is there an option to say, no, that's past history, we're just all Americans? What are you saying?
I'm not saying that we're all
so-called Americans, I'm saying that if we unite together, of course there's a difference. I mean, you know, if you're born in Mexico, raised in Mexico, it's quite different than being born in San Antonio and raised in San Antonio, okay? But those differences we have to iron out and get together, because I see it as a division. And I see that as long as we keep and the ones, in other words, running this country, which is the Anglo establishment, will continue to put a wedge and say, you know, it's different, then we're not going to end nowhere, because it's, you know, I guess it's kind of sad. I really don't know how to put it in words. I don't mean to say, cuando digo somos iguales, somos raza. Okay, whether you're born in Mexico, born in the Estados Unidos, somos raza, okay, somos mexicanos. See, now the difference would be that we have a different history here in the way we're being mistreated, discriminated, everything than mexicanos. And as a matter of fact, a lot of mexicanos come over, and as poor as they are, they sometimes make it, don't they? I mean, they end up having a restaurant or having this or that. Y aquel mexicano de los Estados Unidos, for some reason or other, we can't do that, can we? So I can't say that we're all, the experience is different, but there has to be a way that we can unite. And I think that the fear of establishment is that coming together with the Mexicano, with el migrante, y el Mexicano de Estados Unidos. And I think that the numbers are there to prove that we together can make a difference in this country in addressing the issues. Versus, vamos a ver que, and that's the way, and I think that's what we have to look at, and I know like in Puerto Rico, you know, it's just like I always say, el negro is always, who does it pull for? El negro. I mean, this is quote unquote, the saying is there, blacks pull for blacks, Anglos pull for blacks, Anglos. Y el mexicano, ¿qué hace? ¿Qué dirán? You know, when you're able sometimes to pull, and that's the perception that's been there, that the Mexicano usually will say, no, I don't know, you know, when they have a chance. And they blink. And that's what I'm saying, that's got to change. Now we got to say, hey, Mexicano de aquí o de Estados Unidos, somos iguales, let's help each other, let's unite in the numbers, let's make them citizens, let's get them out to vote, and you're damn right we can take over. That's my dream anyway.
Last question. This is part of an archive of a program that used to be the Mexican Studies program at the University of Texas Arlington. What are your views about Mexican Studies programs at the university level or at the local level, which rarely exist?
Very, very much needed. I think that it's shameful that at this time and age we don't have that. We don't have it in every university. Every university should have it. I'm a strong believer in that, and I think that as a national president of LULAC, if I'm elected, I would like to see that addressed. I would like to see that every university have a Mexican American Studies.
If your prognosis is correct, that we'll take over. It certainly helps be educated, though, and informed about your community, because then you'll be no different than the ones before
if
you have no background.
Absolutely.
Any closing comments?
Well, I just like to say that I don't want to be considered myself as a leader or anybody unusual or anything like that. I think that I've been very lucky to have been given the opportunity to serve in the small way and make a difference in being a representative of LULAC and being a representative of the union. And I think that more involvement is needed. We've got to take a positive approach. I know there's been a lot of negativism, que no se puede, no se puede. When I talk to workers, and me say, no se puede, no se puede, no se va a cambiar nada, Rosa. I say, well, if we never give it a try, pues nunca se va a hacer nada. And I'd like to end up by saying, win, lose, or draw, I will never be among those timid souls that never knew victory or defeat.
All right, thank you. I think you're late for your lunch appointment.
Oh, you never know. What time is it?